Nico.
And I'm Jessica.
And this is the Always the Critic podcast, where a couple of friends review the latest movies, except we have zero qualifications to do so. If this is your first time listening, go ahead and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and many more. If you like us, go ahead and give us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Don't forget to check us out on social media to stay up to date on our latest episodes and reviews. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Always Critic Pod. Now let's get into this.
Yes, today we are going to go over Bong Joon-ho's latest film, Parasite. This has been kind of on our radar for a while now. And I'm very excited to talk about it. Joining us on this episode is frequent guest Miguel Albarracin.
Frequent flyer.
Annyeong haseyo.
Oh. Really quick, a quick synopsis of the movie. All unemployed Ki-taek family takes peculiar interest in the wealthy and glamorous parks for their livelihood until they get entangled in an unexpected incident. Jessica, if you could run down really quick, who is in this movie for us?
Well, you already said who the director is. Is Bong Joon-ho. He did Okja in 2017, which I think went straight to Netflix in the States. So a lot of people can see it right now if you want to. He did Snowpiercer with Chris Evans. Oh my God, Octavia Spencer, Tilda Swinton, The Enigma. He also did The Host, which is a horror movie from 2006, which you can probably easily find as well. It stars Joyo Jung, who plays Park Young-kyo, Lee Sung-kyung, who plays the rich family's father, Park Dong-ik, and Song Kang-ho plays the poor family dad, Kim Ki-taek. And that guy actually is a frequent collaborator with the director. He worked with Bong Joon-ho in The Host and Snowpiercer, so that's something of note. Park So-dam plays the poor family sister, Kim Ki-jung, which, if you haven't already noticed, all the Kims are family and all the Parks are family. And then Choi Woo-shik plays the poor family's brother, Kim Ki-woo. And he was in Train to Busan. If you guys don't know that movie, that's also a zombie horror movie that did very well. And it's actually super good. So go check it out if you want. And Woo-shik was also in a TV series called Fight for My Way with Park So-jun. And Park So-jun has a cameo. I don't know if you guys know who that is, but he's a pretty big star in Korea. He's made the rounds on like the K-dramas and stuff. And Woo-shik played off of him in Fight for My Way, which is a TV drama. And lastly, it's Lee Jong-un, who plays the original housekeeper. And her name was Moon Gwang in the movie. So, how did I do, guys?
I mean,
I think you did pretty well.
You got it covered.
So now, when it comes to this movie itself, it's doing the slow release here in the United States. It's been open internationally for months now. But here in the United States, this past weekend had a $2.3 million opening. It sounds like a little number, but when you compare it to it only opened on 461 screens, that's actually a really good average. Yeah. Overall in the United States, it's made $7.4 million, and that number will continue to grow because it will keep expanding as we get closer to Oscar time. Now, this movie has an almost perfect score on Rotten Tomatoes, 99% on there.
Intense.
And even audiences love it at 93%. So this is a well-liked movie all the way around. So speaking of well-liked, I need to hear some ratings. So Miguel, I want you to start us off. Can you give us what you scored this movie and just give us some general thoughts of what you thought of it?
Okay. I gave it a 4.
Okay. 4 to 5.
Yeah, 4 out of 5. I think it's just very clever. You don't really get a lot of movies like this where it's kind of like a domestic heist. And it's so, for me, like, we'll get into it, but for me, I felt like this was very much like, what's his name? Jordan Peele? his movie Us.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was like exactly what he tried to do, but this was like better. It's just so. Wow. Okay. Yeah, like okay. The absolute takeover of a family's home. Just mm-hmm. It's not slow, but it's not fast. You just have to go with everything that's going on, and the way that it just builds and builds and builds, and when we get to this point, like we'll talk about it later, but it's just so sparse and clean, and mm-hmm. it just never lets up. It's very, very steady, and just it's great. Like, I don't know what else to say. It's just great.
No, that's good enough there. Well, actually, let's get Jessica's thoughts. What's your score and what you get? Why?
I also gave it a 4 out of 5. I went into this blind. I didn't know at all what this movie was about. Legitimately hadn't even watched a trailer. But in watching it, I still thought that I had the plot figured out. So I just loved how, like, despite having zero expectations, Bong Joon-ho, like, managed to defy conventional plot development in an epic, like, misdirection. So I found the ending super surprising and perfect for this movie.
I also gave it a 4 out of 5.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was just completely
even
score all the way around. I think this movie is just a masterclass in intense and a thriller. This movie does bounce in between certain genres. Like, it can be considered a heist movie. It can be considered a thriller. It could be considered a comedy in some points, because I think there's some very funny stuff in this movie. And the way Bong Joon-ho just goes and weaves in and out, but it never feels like it's out of place. Everything feels right where it should be. And also that moment that comes in the movie that kind of changes the expectation of the movie, and you kind of mentioned it, Jessica, I think that was just wonderful, wonderful misdirection. And I can't wait to talk about that. I think that might be one of my favorite moments that I've seen in a movie this year, just because of, like, it's so...
You do not expect it? No, like, if you had asked me before the movie, like, what do you think this movie is about? At maybe 20 to 30 minutes into the movie, how was it going to turn out? I would have never in a million years guessed the ending or how it was going to just 180 on us.
Oh, yeah.
Really... So this is great. That's a great feeling, because we watch movies all the time, and I feel like we have stuff pretty well in hand when it comes to plot development and, like, oh, I see where this is going, or this is a bit heavy-handed, and this felt like it was going down, I don't want to say a predictable, like, hole.
Right.
Route. I think it was just hitting some comfort beats for everybody.
Yeah.
And then it just, man, he hit the gas, and, like,
yes.
I don't think anyone expected.
It was a Trojan horse. The way that like the way he delivers that plot twist too is an absolute Trojan horse, because when what happens happens.
It's just,
we'll have to get into spoilers.
But. And we will in just a moment. Really quick, for those who have seen some of the other movies, how familiar are you with Bong Joon-ho's previous work before this? I personally have only seen one of the movies that Jessica mentioned earlier, and that was Snowpiercer from 2013. I actually found that movie to be fantastic. I think you can draw a parallel between that movie and this movie in terms of its discussion on social class and the poor versus the rich. So I think he has a theme there. Does anybody else have any more experience? I think, Jessica, you've seen Okja, right?
I've seen Okja, which is pretty bizarre. I would say it's about a sentient pig that gets raised to be slaughtered later, and it turns into this whole thing with, like, I don't want to spoil it, but basically it's about a pig and this girl who wants to save her pig. So Snowpiercer, just like you said, it's all about, you know, I don't want to say classism, because at that, in Snowpiercer, it's like way beyond classism.
I think that is just like the overall point, but like you can really like
dig in. It's post-apocalyptic, so there's that. The Host, which I have also seen, is a monster movie. Like, there's a monster that comes out of the Han River in Seoul and it starts wreaking havoc. And so it's a straight up monster movie. I think that he's over time, like, because The Host was in 2006 and Snowpiercer is 2013, Okja's 2017. I feel like he's really honed his craft in terms of storytelling and in terms of what does the movie look like. Because if you look at The Host, that's a totally different looking movie than Snowpiercer and Okja, which are really a lot more refined. And there's not so much like, or The Host, I remember being like color graded, like kind of orangey. Snowpiercer is a like kind of like a greenish blue, but what, like, you know, not drastic, but that's just the general like tone of it. Okja, the same thing, is not very, it's not either swinging to one side or the other, but it looks very crisp. The cinematography is like polished. I want to say that it's polished. And so coming into this movie, I felt the same way, where I remember turning to you guys and I was like, I really like how this movie looks.
Yes.
It's because so sharp.
It's
sharp. The design of the everywhere they are, the house that, you know, the Parks live in, or even the semi-basement that the Kims live in, everything is shot very well. Even if it's like, you know, down on the dumps, Kim's family, everything is shot in this way that makes you think, wow, this actually looks good to actually see. And I think the way that the camera moves in certain moments, it just enhances certain things or certain scenes, the way either the camera either pulls out of a scene or pushes in or just moves around, kind of viewing the scope of everything that's going on, I think is so well done.
It's mature. He's definitely matured over time. Oh, for sure. And didn't this movie win something?
Yes, it did. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. So basically the best picture at Cannes. So so this movie has been on the radar for a while now.
He got like a standing ovation. I remember there was a lot of coverage of that because it's a big deal for a foreign director, foreign movie to get that honor.
Yeah, because he actually became the first Korean director to win the award, which is
sweet.
Yeah, so that's a big one. But yeah, so it was a big deal that this movie won that award. So that's why there's a lot of expectation. And I'll be honest, I went in with expectations just because there has been so much, you know, so much conversation.
There was a lot of hype, and I don't want to say that it met all of that hype, because it was just in a different manner. It met the expectations that I had for it, just in general. Like, I think it's going to be a great movie, and it was. Mm-hmm. Like,
exactly.
But, you know.
And I think that...
I don't think this is for everybody either.
It's definitely not.
No?
No.
Really?
I don't think
it's approachable enough, but there's going to be something that messes it up for a lot of people.
Yeah, I feel like I'm pretty familiar with Korean culture as it's portrayed on screen. And so it felt very familiar to me.
I feel okay,
but
so coming
I know
from
that
the
some
side.
People. Yeah, yeah. How did you feel about like watching this family, watching this culture, and seeing how like the two halves live, because one family is extremely poor and the other family is extremely wealthy?
I mean, I don't think it's that far-fetched to say that we have seen movies here in America that kind of do similar things and contrasting a very rich family with a very poor family. Mm. So that part didn't faze me at all. If anything, for me, the hardest, and this is just my own sensibility.
Right, what was the hardest thing to understand?
Is just, you know, I want to be paying attention to the movie itself, but I have to read everything. So, you know, having it in a different language, you know, you struggle with that, you know, I'm reading the entire movie basically, and I can't pay attention to the visuals as much as I want to. But that's something on me.
Okay. No, it's fine.
You know.
So, I feel like me and Miguel watch way more foreign stuff, and
we're pretty comfortable.
I think after a while, when you've watched a lot of media with subtitles, I think anybody feels this way. It's kind of like you remember those magic eye things where you stare at like a blurry picture and suddenly you see something popping out.
Yeah,
it's kind of like that. You've seen so many shows and movies with subtitles that you can still watch it while still seeing the subs right over it. It just goes hand in hand once in a while. But I think that there's something that that's going to lose a lot of people. It has to do with the ending, though.
All right. So let's go
into spoilers.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and let's jump into spoilers.
The greatest trick.
Houston, we have a problem.
I am the father.
I see dead people.
The devil ever pulled.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Was convincing the world.
You can't handle the truth.
He didn't exist.
Oh, what's in the box?
What's the first thing we need to talk about here in spoilers? Is it the twist?
Let's get the twist out of the way because we're gonna refer back to it and people are gonna be like, well, if I didn't watch it, then what's the twist?
Okay.
So
the main twist, okay, so the general concept of the movie is this family, the Kims, has basically infiltrated the Park family.
Because they have all of this hired help.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So the dad becomes the driver. The son becomes a tutor. The daughter becomes another type of
art therapist.
Then the mom becomes a housekeeper. All within the family.
All infiltrated, and they use less than reputable means of worming their way in, because obviously there were people in those positions before them.
Exactly.
So they had to basically dump all of the hired help that was already there and worm their way in.
Yeah, and so after they're able to worm themselves into this house and the Parks go away, you know, for a weekend getaway, you know, they're kind of celebrating what they've done. You know, we finally made it. You know, this could be our house if we play our cards right. And this is where the twist happens. The old housekeeper.
So, boom. Right here at this moment, they're celebrating, they're drinking, they're drunk in the house. Yes. In the wealthy family's house while they're gone.
Wealthy family's house.
How did you think the movie was going to end? Because at this
point,
I thought that they were going to assume the rich family's identity. Because they were asking for personal information from them for whatever reason. Like, oh, I need your ID. I need your this. Like, I need your... like personal information that could help them take over their identification. I was like, oh, they're going to assume the identity for some. How, I don't know, but they will do it. That was my thought.
That was my thought too. I figured that, you know, they would try to assume the identity. Then the Park family would kind of fight back in a way, not necessarily physically, but they would find a way to try to get back at the Kims, and then it would enter some type of altercation. That was my thought.
So you thought it was going to devolve into violence somehow because both the families want to be on top.
Eventually, I figured that part would.
Miguel, what were your thoughts at this moment before the twist?
I thought I thought what was going to happen was they were going to slowly kill off people in the family.
Same.
And take over completely. I didn't think it was like, oh, we stole your identity, we live here now. Like, no, I thought they were going to actually start murdering them.
Same.
Where's my son? Well, I took him to a art camp retreat, whatever. Oh, where's my daughter for tutoring? Oh, I sent her to math camp. Like, slowly start killing them off as they're getting rid. Because that's where they're leading us by the hand with the Ajumma who, like, cleans the house, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you have this lady cleaning the house, the house lady.
Yeah.
And then they just, like, basically poison her to make her leave.
Yeah. That was brutal to have them, like, find her weakness, which was she's allergic to peaches. And they're freaking, like, throwing peach fuzz dust on her.
And I love how dramatic it is.
To simulate that she has, like, active TB. I mean, it's just brutal. It's so elaborate.
They put hot sauce in a napkin to make it look like she's coughing up blood.
Yeah, which right, that's yeah. comedic as well, because when the dad takes it out and like the slow-mo shot oh, yeah, of him like throwing peach fuzz
onto her. Oh, that's another thing. So here, so the twist comes. So the old housekeeper, the one that they threw the peach fuzz on her.
We'll just call her Ajima.
So yeah. she comes back to the house. Wanting, begging to come in, she forgot something. And so, you know, after much hesitance, they go ahead, they open the door, and she immediately runs towards the cellar.
Cellar.
And so they're wondering what. So then the mother goes down and sees her trying to, like, push the cabinet away from the wall. And it turns out that there is a door behind that cabinet and leads down into a bunker, and in that bunker is the old housemaid's husband. They have been living there for years. She had her husband hidden down there, living there, because he can't get work, and it's tough, like, and he owes debt as well, and so the housekeeper has been hiding her husband down in that bunker for years, and nobody knew about it.
Which isn't even that implausible when you consider that she's lived there before that family even got there.
Exactly. She has been. The old housekeeper has been living there for years. I was so surprised that this is where the movie went. And
never saw it coming.
No, I didn't see it coming at all. And it was so, like, I had no words to say, and it was so tense because all of a sudden the Park family's coming back, so they cut their weekend short. So you have the Kims, who are making a mess because they're drunk. You have the newly discovered husband that's downstairs, and they're threatening to tell the Parks about what the Kims are doing. And
right, but this turns into like a hostage situation, yeah, because all of the Kims start creeping downstairs to see what their mom is experiencing and trying to hear what's going on between Mama Kim and Ajima with her husband, who's like super frail, about to die down there because he hasn't had food. And they ruin it. They, like, fall down the stairs. She gets video of them. It gets really tense down there. And Ajima basically has them on the run for, like, you know, the next sequence. Because they're in the corner with their hands up, with their arms up. Which is a position of... it's a prostrate position. Like, kids in school, if they do wrong... They do that. They make them do that.
They make them hold up their hands until they're too tired.
Hold up their arms.
Yeah. I see.
Arms. It's a punishment.
It's, you know? I found it interesting just how terrible everybody involved was. They were all so desperate to be in a life that they're just not invited to. That the older family, like, reminisce, or the couple down in the bunker reminisces about the good old days when they had the home all to themselves.
I and guess the architect the new family, that built it wasn't, like, there all the time or something.
Right. So they would spend all this time upstairs together in the sun. And then the new family is so desperate to be in that house that they were going to call the police on the couple in the bunker. As if they had a leg to stand on. Like, they were just like, no, you're right. done.
There's a level of, like... hypocritism, like, I don't think that's the right word, but hypocrisy. Like, hypocrisy. Sorry, my bad. There's a level of hypocrisy here that is unheard of, because yeah, the Kim family was like, you know, get the fuck out, and lo and behold, they're also squatters, so, you know, who are you?
That was great.
Exactly.
It was awesome.
Who are you?
And I think it was a very Trojan horse sequence, because when I saw, I think the way that they framed that scene with the intercom, because you're feeling like, okay, this family is getting completely, like, plastered. Yeah. They're getting way too comfortable in this house. And when that doorbell rings, You think, oh my God, the family came back.
It's a family, yeah.
But they get to the door, and the way it's framed with the camera, you see the old Ajuma just like with her bruised eyes and everything looking in. Hi, can you please let me
in?
She
cackles when she's, yeah. When they ask her who she is, she's like, ah.
Like, I thought she was going to go in there and like.
I thought she went crazier that she was drunk, but.
Or she was going to try to murder them or something.
Yeah. Uh huh.
It was a lot.
So even then, you have literally no clue that she. She's like, I forgot something here. And she runs in, goes down to the cellar, and like, lo and behold, she's trying to open like this secret passageway. And like,
didn't she cut the CCTV?
She cut the CCTV outside the house.
Why did she do that again?
So that nobody knew that she came by the house.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I think this movie delivers on some very good performances overall. Actually, we got a question regarding that on Twitter from Offscreen Babble, friends of the show. They mentioned that they absolutely love Parasite. And who gave your favorite performance in the film? For them, it was hard to pick because they think that everyone did an amazing job. So does anybody have a standout performance in this movie from any
characters? Sister.
The sister?
I like the sister only because she had some really meaty parts. Yeah. Park Seo-dam, she did really good because she, oh God, how do we put it? She totally lied to the mom, to the rich family's mom, the Park mom, about her son needing therapy and that she was an art therapist / art teacher.
Right.
She had this whole backstory in the palm of her hand. She had them in the palm of her hand. Like, everything was so well done for her. You know, interjecting when the mom starts talking and just being so in control of her position there. I guess it was the scariest of all four of them because she also orchestrated the departure of the driver. She like framed the driver by taking off her underwear and leaving her underwear in the bottom of the seat.
Yeah.
She was an advanced liar. She was an advanced liar. She took command of every situation that she was in.
Yeah, she was awesome at what she did. So I think that she was the scariest of them all. Everyone seemed a little more like low time.
Yeah.
I don't.
You would think that she was the one who came up with it to begin with.
Yeah, because it feels like she's so calculating throughout. Yeah.
She was doing like the Photoshop work to create like the fake diploma for the brother. And, you know, she just had a lot of skills on her and.
The movie devolves in such a good way.
She cut her hair. They all cut their hair and
they
like
colored it and they cleaned up.
Yeah, it was good.
It was really good.
I did like Joyo Jong, who plays the Park family mom, the rich mom. She was pretty good as well.
Yeah.
I think those two were my standouts. Because when I think the moment for the Park family mom was when this is between the two of them, actually. When Sister Kim, we'll call her Sister Kim, says, oh, did your son have something happen to him in the first grade? And she just goes, like her gasp when she said that out loud. I mean, she took her by a complete surprise. And I thought that she was felt super genuine in her emotions. And she definitely took that naivety and like, did something with it. Like, it didn't seem like she was necessarily foolish. It definitely felt like she was just
Posh.
A trusting, rich individual, you know? Mm-hmm. Very naive. Not necessarily like she's a fool. Like,
she's just completely disconnected from the outside world. Like, what's that quote? It's a banana. What could it cost? $10? That's basically like, that's how she views the world. Painful. She's so disconnected, but not even rude.
I think that's an excellent point right there, because
that's what they said. The whole family said that. They were like, she's so nice.
Right. So you have this dynamic in this movie between the rich and the poor. I don't think it's very subtle in how it's saying basically in this movie. How did you guys feel about the the rich versus the poor dynamic. Is there anything that stands out from those either moments or scenes that really intensify that, you know, how different these two families are?
The smell was the one that really left an impression on me. There's a point where the youngest son of the Park family runs up to the father and the mother, really, of the family that's conning them, and says, basically, they smell alike. Yeah, I smell the same.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of gets shoved under the rug, and his parents tell him to stop being rude. But then later, the father overhears the rich father talking about how, oh, you know, the only bad thing about the driver is that, you know, he kind of smells.
This happens during a very tense part when they are hiding.
Yeah.
After they come home and they are under the family room table when they overhear this about the smell.
And the father is becoming increasingly humiliated because he's talking about, yeah, he has this smell, like this smell that you only smell at a Subway or in a Subway. It's very like rank and whatever. And this theme keeps getting hit on. They keep hitting on this theme. The father's getting increasingly humiliated by this rich family. This kind of comes to like a clash when there's that huge like kill out happening at the end. And there's this body splayed out on the ground, all stabbed. But when the rich father goes to touch him, to move him, to grab his keys from under the body, he just covers his nose because of the smell, which drives the father into a frenzy. It seems like odors were used as a representation for the whole poor thing throughout the movie. Like that, like the contempt that rich people have for the poor based off of something like a smell, like, oh, you guys reek, you guys this.
Which I think the smell in our terminology will be called grajo. It's grajo. But anyway, right. The smell, I felt the same way that the father was okay with everything up until he started talking about how the way he smelled.
Yeah.
And even late, again, it just comes back over and over again when the Park mom is getting driven around by the Kim dad.
She notices the smell and rolls down the window.
She freaking rolls down the window while she's on the phone because she smells his odor, whatever it is. And that was after their night, like, that their house got flooded and there was like sewer water that they were wading through. And it was like horrible, horrible for them. They had a terrible night. And this family doesn't ask about their circumstances or anything. Like, obviously they don't know that they're a family unit, but you know, if someone is not striking you like they're having the best time or that they stink, like maybe you should ask them, like, where do you live? Like, you know, how do you, you know, is there anything I can do to kind of help you out? Because, you know, we can help you, you know? I don't know if I'm making this clear.
No, that makes sense. Yeah. I just don't see a super rich family like that in that culture.
They just kind of tolerate like it.
Right, they tolerate it. Yeah,
they live around it.
They just tolerate it. They have no, they do not care like what they do in their off time or where they go when they leave. They just care about what they're doing when they're in their employ.
Which to be fair.
Fine.
Which is a very, very typical, at least way rich people are portrayed. It's more like, what are you doing for me? Thank you. And that's it. That's a transaction.
Nowhere more prevalent than in the end of the movie where the Kim dad and the Park dad are there with like very intricate Native American headpieces going to surprise the kid and they're hiding in the bushes. And the dad, the rich dad, says, you know, you're getting paid to be here. So like the least you can do is like do this.
Yeah. Consider this a part of your workday since you're already paid to be here.
Yeah.
Right. I think it was just it's kind of awful.
It's degrading, yeah. I think. And especially in that moment.
They treat him worse than anybody.
Plus, on top of that, they use at least what the typical rich person would use is that money is the answer. Mm. You know, if you're getting paid for something, that should be enough. Mm-hmm. You know, no consideration of how it feels for someone or how they may, you know, stand in that certain situation. All that matters is, hey, I am paying you. This is a service. It's a transaction.
Mm-hmm.
Do it. That's mm-hmm. So I think that dynamic, seeing that there, obviously we see it face to face with the characters.
The smell, though.
The smell is the big one.
The thing
one.
Is, they, the family doesn't common. Smell the smell.
No, because they live in it.
Because they live in it.
Another thing that
we so how see, can they ever? How can they ever, like, smell good or get past the smell or, like, you know, fix it?
Is unless live in a livable place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, unless they, like, move out of the slums. Like, unless they move out of, like, their semi-basement where they're dealing with pests like cockroaches and rats and...
Surprise fumigations from the outside. Surprise flooding.
Fumigations from the outside.
It's behind a restaurant, so there's, like, this stench that wafts in.
Somewhat, like, there's a constant stream of, like, drunk people coming to pee, like, right outside their window. Like, there's no way for them to, like, get out.
But to be fair, like, on the other side... Well, not fair, because it's definitely not. If you look at it, the driver is the one, the father gets treated the worst, because he's like the driver, right? But the others are presenting themselves to be something completely different. And they don't say anything about them. For example, you know, if you had hired a tutor for your daughter and he comes in wearing a nice suit, comes in perfectly composed and this and that, comes on time, leaves on time, you wouldn't think anything of it. The daughter, who's like the mega con woman, like super ultra con artist, tutoring the kid, very well composed, talks about high concept things and philosophy and psychology. You don't think twice about stuff like that. So it was easy for them to all slide under the radar. It's only the dad that, like, really falls, like, makes a blip for them.
I agree with that. It's something, I don't know if it's supposed to be symbolic or just maybe just not even subtext, just text, like, hey, this is how the rich view the poor, or this is how
the right, poor, they stink.
Yeah, they stink. They are lower mm-hmm. than low. Mm-hmm. The rich families are oblivious to them unless they are bothering them in some way, shape, or form, and the smell could be one way.
I think that the rich view the poor as a nuisance.
Yes.
And whether that's text or subtext, they view the stench as a nuisance.
Yes. Now, you have an interesting question, Jessica. And who is the real parasite?
Yes. Because the title of the movie is Parasite, I kept thinking that there was going to be an obvious moment where we knew who the parasite was. And I don't think there is, like, a true moment.
No, there isn't.
Where you're like, oh, this is who the movie's about. Because if you're looking at this family, obviously they are a parasite to the rich family. But there's also the secondary family, the Ajumma and her husband, who are also parasites. And who is, if they're both parasites, then who is worse?
They should have just called it parasites, honestly.
No.
No?
Parasite's no. Fine. Parasite as a name is fine.
Okay. Well, whatever. They're all parasites. They're all sucking off of each other. It depends, because the Ajumma was there honestly, right? She didn't have any foul play in staying in that house over time, did she? I don't think they mentioned that.
Except for the fact that she was hiding her husband all those years.
She was
years.
Hiding her husband for 4 years in the bunker
yeah.
that right. they had.
Yeah, but she's living there anyway, right?
And she chose not to tell the current family that there is a bunker down there that is made for their protection.
Yeah, so that whole family thing doesn't know.
It's made for their... She says rich families have this and they build this into their homes. It's for their protection. Should the North invade the South?
Right.
Oh, right.
Should North Korea invade South Korea, they have this underground bunker that they could live and get away from whatever chaos is outside. And instead, the real, like, this parasite is living in the bunker without this rich family even knowing that there's a bunker there for them.
So the poorer families are all the parasites.
Yeah, I think it's
because on the other end, like, maybe that you can make an argument that the dad, the rich dad, is maybe a parasite for
putting them in a corporate parasite.
I guess so. Putting them in situations immediately outside of their control, but at the same time, they're kind of like paying them. So not really.
No. I think this
centers
more around the lower class.
You could argue in a really offshoot way that the dad, the rich father, the Park dad, is a parasite to his wife. Because when the Kim dad says, well, it's all okay because you love her, right? And he goes, love? Yeah, you could say I love her.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, what a dick thing to say.
That's a,
like,
terrible thing to say.
To anyone. But
really quick, let's go ahead and answer the second question that we have from Twitter. This is from our friend Colby at Colby Told Me. The last 20 minutes of Parasite, does it work or does it jump the shark? So that sounds like Colby didn't really enjoy the end of that movie.
Huh.
So this is where I thought everybody would lost everybody, actually. This is where I thought the movie was going to lose everybody.
Okay, so this is the moment where you were like, I think that people who are maybe not Korean would see it and be like, what?
It's an ending that we're used to seeing so much. Like, the rest of the movie is pretty universal in how it works. Like, you could follow along with it, you know, whatever.
I guess this is part of the reason why me and Miguel are constantly like, why don't they just kill off all the Avengers?
Right, exactly.
Because we're seeing this kind of thing all the time. We're like, yeah, it's fine.
We see things where people are like killed and then nobody bats an eye. But I think where they lose everybody is that last bit of like, where it suddenly turns very poetic. And he's like, and then I come back to the house every day and I promise I will work to reunite with
you. Well, there was a voiceover where there was no voiceover before.
That's such a Korean drama, Japanese drama thing to do. So I think that that's where they're going to lose a lot of people.
I think that time jumps are not a Western thing to do.
Not really.
They had a time jump in here. The events happen at the end.
Let me ask this question. Do you think what was being shown is real?
No.
No, right?
No.
That's fantasy.
It will happen. It's like a possible future. It's the future that is
the hopeful future.
The hopeful future.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of took it as that as well because of the fact that they came back to show the son, Kim. Basically, he has that letter that he sent to his father, which in reality, we don't even know if he sent that letter to the father.
Let's not forget that this is a situation that his father communicates with him from the bunker using a Morse code system on a lamp to write him basically a 4-page letter about his situation in the bunker. And then he writes a letter back. And it's, for me, we watch Korean dramas all the time. So this kind of wistful, poetic, very contemplative kind of ending with a voiceover and wistful voice is common. But I think they're going to lose. They probably lost or would lose a ton of people, at least on the second viewing. Because does it work? If you're expecting it kind of as a trope, yeah, I was kind of able to go with that. I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. But I don't know. How did you feel watching all of that as someone who doesn't really watch things like this?
I think that for the most part, it's fine. Everything leading up to the moment right after the death was where I am fully on board with this movie. This movie had me great. After the death and after the dad escapes, that next set of events where we see the son gets, he's recovering from his surgery. They get a job and then he's climbing a mountain, viewing the bunker stuff. That stuff gets a little bit hazy for me in terms of
that's the time jump that you're not used to.
No, not that I'm not used to. I just
and
felt
a tonal
like,
change too.
It's a tonal change and a time jump, change. And that's very common.
Right,
it's super common.
Okay, yeah. But if it's common, but does that make it good? Is the question.
It's not about being good or bad. It fits this exact kind of movie.
It's a style that you're not used to because that's the style is
okay,
we're going to interrupt
question.
The flow.
Do you like that tonal shift?
I think so, just because I'm used to it and because I expect it. Because make no mistake, and I don't know if Jessica agrees with me on this one, but even though that's not exactly what we see in the future, that's a pretty good indication of what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they set the expectation of, I will work very hard and I'll make my way back to you, we may not see it pan out, but it is going to happen. So even though it may not be an exact shot of what happens, it's going to happen. They're going to have that ending.
They're gonna reunite. I mean, that's...
It's gonna happen. There's no way around it. So is it? It's a very difficult question that you're asking because, like, we keep saying it's something that exists in these films, in these Korean dramas, in these things. I can't suddenly put it on a Western lens because I'm watching it here. Like, it's just something that I'm used to, and I like it, but it's not like. It's kind of hard to judge, like, when you put it in that lens, if it's good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's just what we're kind of expect.
Right. Well, yeah.
That's like saying the will they, won't they in a sitcom. Is it good or is it bad? Like, yeah, it's a tired trope, but it's what you expect. They get together at the end of a romantic comedy. Yeah. I mean, is it good or bad? No, but it's what you expect. The twist where it was all in their head, the end question mark. Was it good? Was it bad? No, you don't know because it's case-by-case basis and it's something that you're already expecting.
Right, and in this case is how I'm referring to that.
You keep expecting us to say, no, we didn't like it,
it. No, that's fine. If you guys liked it, you guys liked it.
Are you asking if it's objectively good?
We can't judge that because, again, it's subjective. There's nothing objective you could say.
Here's what I'll say about this.
That's a good or bad choice.
If you're familiar with these movies from Korea, Japan, China, Taiwan, anything, if you're familiar with those kind of movies, it's exactly what you're expecting. If you don't watch movies like this, it's like I said from the very beginning, I think that's where they're going to lose a lot of people. If you're not used to watching movies like this, if you don't watch a lot of movies like this, that last bit is going to feel like either jumping the shark or, like, it just doesn't fit with the rest of the movie, but it's because you don't watch movies like this. Now, you may not like it, and that's completely fair, too, because you have, you know, maybe you've not seen enough of it, or maybe you have and you don't like it. But I do think that that's where they're going to lose a lot of people. Do I think it's bad? No. I watch stuff like this all the time, and it is precisely what I was expecting. But
I don't think it was any less touching because it was contemplative and voiceover.
Neither do I.
Different from the rest of the movie. Like, I don't think that was an issue for me at all.
Gotcha.
Because I was still reeling from, like, wow, like, the dad really did that. The dad is really missing. Like, I was still following with what he's saying. Like, wow, they got off on probation and they straight up, like, you know, did all this shit.
Even the law recognized what a shit show the whole situation was. And they were like, you know what, let's call it a draw and let's keep going. Call it a wash. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even the son had the traumatic brain injury where he's laughing all the time. It's tragic.
Yeah.
The daughter died. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Let me put it this way. If this movie was done here, the trope that this movie would have ended with was he got the brain injury. And then at the end, they would have shown him in a mental institution. Did it really happen? And would that have been good or bad?
That would have been bad. That would have been a bad ending. And the reason why I asked this question is just because Colby asked the question, does it jump the shark? I don't think it jumps the shark. I think that, again, it's not something that we're used to in terms of how usually Western movies are ended, you know, how they're finished. Or how their stories end compared to...
Well, this wasn't a definitive ending, and I don't think that people will be okay with that. Like, not only the tonal change, not only the time jump, not only voiceover and everything. It doesn't have a definitive ending. Do they get reunited? Maybe. Like,
and it's maybe all those little things that dropped it from a 4.5 to a 4.
Maybe the father dies in the basement. Like,
Right. It's all those little things. Maybe
it was all in his head.
It's all those little things at the end that dropped the score for me from a 4.5 to a 4. As me I was too. Thinking about it. Because everything leading up to that is just fantastic. And then it just, because of that shift of tone and different things, it's that's where it kind of like, okay, so it's a palate cleanser in a way. But
the family didn't improve their circumstances. They are still living in the semi-basement. Like
right.
After all the money that they earned while working there too.
I don't care if they don't have a happy ending. Like that to me, like I, you know, if they had a happy ending, a sad ending, bad ending, that's fine. It's, I guess it's just the way that it ended, at least for me, that I just, I guess I'm not either appreciative of, or I just didn't find to be that great, which is why my score reflects that, even though this movie is fantastic. Now, we do have another question. Well, yeah, we do have another question. Mm-hmm. And it's, what are your thoughts on Parasite's Oscar chances? I believe that it's such a strong movie that it has a real shot at sweeping the Oscars. That is from Pop Poor Review Podcast on Twitter.
Thoughts on Oscar chances.
Best foreign film, if anything.
I was going to say, can this even skip over and be like best picture or something like that?
I don't think it wins.
Because it's foreign?
Yeah, because it's foreign. I think that the Academy won't give it its due because of that. I'm not saying it's not a bad movie and it doesn't deserve to win. But if you look at history, it's so hard, first off, to get a foreign movie to be nominated for Best Picture. That's tough in itself. And I can't even remember the last time that a foreign picture won Best Picture. I'll be honest with you, I can't remember. So will it get nominated? I believe so. I think this will be a movie that gets nominated. Bong Joon-ho will get nominated. The performances will not. So the question was, do you think it has a real shot of sweeping? No, not at all.
I think Roma was the last time.
Yeah, that was last year.
A foreign film got nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars. Right.
It was last year, but it's so rare to see it. We're seeing it more, so maybe there's a changing of the guard at the Oscars in the Academy, but I just don't think it's enough. Where this particular movie...
I mean,
movie,
Roma was very... it seemed like an Academy darling.
It was a critical darling. It was not an Academy darling.
Okay, because the black and white and the whole
critics
like,
loved
thing.
It. Critics loved that movie, but Roma didn't even come close to winning Best Picture because there was few movies that, whether we agree with it or not... were above it in the rankings and above it in voting. So, yeah,
this movie's not
darling.
Sweeping anything.
No, this movie's not going to sweep a thing. If Bong Joon-ho wins for Best Directing, it'll be a great surprise. Maybe Best Original Screenplay. I believe it's an original screenplay. But that's really it. I don't see anything else in its chances. So
yeah, there's no way.
I would like to see it nominated, but I don't think it has a chance of winning.
Soundtrack's great.
Soundtrack's really good.
Oh, it's so good.
Overall, I think this movie's really good. And
how did you guys feel about the rock, the Prosperity Stone,
Chekhov's rock?
Chekhov's rock.
I mean, they showed it so many times that it was just like, okay, so when is it going to come into play?
Hoisted by his own petard. That was pretty poetic. I liked it.
Man.
Just cracks him right in the skull. And then once he's on the floor, just once more for good measure. I was like, damn.
Yeah.
Because even then I was like, he's not going to do it. I don't think he's going to do it.
But that's the thing. What? I don't. They're all terrible. I mean, I'm not saying they all deserve it, but I was just like... That's what I found fascinating about this movie is I'm looking at this family infiltrate the other person, like these people's lives. And then I see the other people, the guy who is living down there, literally trying to survive off of this family like a parasite. And he's fighting back. He's like, nah, it's either you or me. So he cracks him on the head with the rock. And it's like, oh, that's where we're going.
That's another thing.
I mean, he's in a bad place. He's in a terrible place because his wife just died down there. She got pushed down the stairs. Yeah. You know, so
he but was he wasn't going to amicably make his way out anyway. There was just no way.
No.
Even with his wife being alive.
I was surprised that the movie just, like, it did, they didn't kill the son even after it looked like he was killed. Because not only did he get the stone to the head once, he got it twice. And the second time was a clear shot right to the head. So I'm surprised that, like, he didn't die from that. That was a
he just got a permanent traumatic brain injury. And right. His motor skills were affected. So considering he was the one who got the ball rolling on the whole scheme, he had to stay alive.
Right. It was just surprising to me the way they did it. I mean, it just
makes you think, like, well, how exactly is he going to make money to buy the house later?
That's true, too.
Like, he has a major traumatic brain injury that he's now recovering from. And, like, what can he possibly do? He was a bum before. Like, now he's damaged. Like, what can he do?
Hence the wistful.
It's so Korean. Like, I don't know.
It's the most Korean thing. It's like that trope whenever they stand on that river that separates North and South Korea. And they're like, one day I'll make my way back to you. And the pan flute starts playing.
I don't think that Korean films particularly like to put a hard stop on anything. There's always going to be an ellipsis at the end of the story. So...
But not in a vague, did they, don't they? Like, that's the big takeaway from that ending. You can't interpret it as, is that the real? It's not about being real or not. This is the character's motivation as soon as the movie's over. And it's exactly what you're right. It's an ellipsis. There's always, we're going to show at least what this character intends to do next.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Gotcha. So, let's go ahead and start to wrap it up. Guys, anything that you think is going to stand out towards the end of the year? I would say one thing that I will never forget, at least not for this year, is when they're retelling the story of the encounter that the dad from downstairs in the bunker has with the little kid.
Yes, and I was just going to say that too. God. Oh, my God.
His eyes, just his bulging eyes.
How did they even light that?
Oh, my God.
How did they light that like that? Beautifully lit. He looked like a freaking goblin.
He did.
Oh, my God. It was so scary.
It was terrifying.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I was just going to say the same thing. I'm so glad you said it first. Because, like, if I was the only one, like, trying to explain this scene of, like, this flashback of why the kid is messed up in the head, this traumatic experience, it gave him like a freaking epileptic attack.
Yes.
Because he was so shook from the visual.
Oh, let's not forget, God. And that's so, like, just the entrance to the cellar is horrifying. Like, it's just really a beautiful, beautiful cabinet of alcohol wall to wall, but it's this black, pitch black pit that leads to pitch black doorway with no door that just leads to stairs. It's terrifying. That whole room is horrifying.
Yeah, ugh. It is.
But that visual of the
with the eyes just, and it's half his head just like
husband. Oh my God. And like I was telling my coworker today, I was because we were both talking about this scene. It makes such an impression, leaves such a vibe. So we were talking about the scene, and I was like, but that's not even the correct way for someone who's trying not to be seen, trying not to, like, is cautious and looking up to see if anyone's there. That's not the facial expression that person has. Like, that is a crazy person that looked out from the basement.
Oh, for sure. Like, he was always a nutter. You know what I'm saying? That's why earlier when you said that he was shook about his wife being, like, killed. No. That guy was a nutter.
That guy was a freaking nutter. Him, like, banging his head against the freaking light just to say thank you to the park dad.
Remember, he's been down there for at least 20 years. He's been down there since the architect.
Four years. It's 4 years.
Was it only four?
Yeah, four
why
years.
Why did it seem like longer?
Because he's crazy.
Oh, yeah. He's all weathered and battered down.
He was crazy. That man, he only has 3 acting credits to his name, and it includes Parasite.
Oh my God.
Like, he is fresh.
It's definitely the standout scene.
Yeah, it is. It is the standout scene.
It's just chilled. I'm chilled.
Anything else that you think is going to stand out from this movie at the end of the year?
Standout?
Yeah. either any performance.
No.
But I like the scene of like them trying to get out of the house once the family comes back from camping.
It's so tense.
That is the most tense that the movie ever got. It was so like, are they going to get out? Are they not? Are they going to get found?
Yes.
Like, for me, it's when the Ajumma showed up. And she's like, I cut the CCTV, and she's standing there in the rain. They haven't let her in, and you see the wires cut on the camera. I'm like, oh my God, what is going to happen to this family?
What the hell is going
to
happen?
I thought she was going to go in and kill everybody, like, or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Overall, I think we all really enjoy this movie. I think the most of us, at the end of the year, you know, it'll most likely fall in our favorite movies of the year, most likely. Speaking of which... in my personal top 10, it is in my top 10. It's at number 5.
What?
It's at number 5.
Number what?
Number nice. 5. I think that it's so well done.
Wow.
Just masterful how this movie is. Even with my qualms of, you know, the very end, even with that, it's still such a great movie. I honestly want to see it again. I can't wait to see it again. And yeah, it's a very good movie, and I personally would recommend it to a lot of people, regardless of, you know, if they're into foreign films or not or anything. I would definitely recommend it. So yeah, this is a very good movie. Any final thoughts before we get out of here?
What did the family call the sirloin? Sirloin mixed with like ramen.
Oh,
I don't remember what they called it, but
I forgot what the meal was called. Yeah, it looked so delicious though.
That was basically ramen noodles with sirloin steak, which is like a steak of any kind. Meat is expensive, right?
Yeah,
that is not sirloin is not cheap, right? So even the meal that the family had,
Ramdon.
It was like.
Ramdon?
Ramdon.
So even that meal was like ramen or ramyun is like it's poor people's food.
Yeah, but she, remember, I think she doesn't know how to make it, so she half-assed.
But she doesn't know how to make ramen. Again, like this is, if you've watched a lot of foreign stuff, like everyone knows how to make ramen.
Yeah.
That's easy. And then she's not only like, make me ramen, but put sirloin steak in it. That's like unheard of.
That's great, though.
I was like, is she serious?
Or how about giving them like peach water from, not fermented peach, but like that peach drink? Or no, the plums. Like, it'll help you study better. It's like, okay. Cool. Like all of that and those plums are expensive too. Like everything in that house was like mad expensive.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, like that whole thing of like her eating the ramen and the kid didn't want it and like the dad didn't want it, so the mom just ate it. It was like they don't even value like a meal, you know?
No, they really don't. And
a meal that like others would find basic and like extra at the same time.
It's easy to take things for granted when they're granted.
They just take it for granted, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Again, this is more of that rich versus poor dynamic.
It's a huge difference. Yeah.
That's a Tuesday meal for them. It's like, nah, I don't think I'll have sirloin steak.
I mean, considering like the Kim family was freaking like dying for Wi-Fi.
Oh, yes. Yeah, exactly.
At the beginning of the movie.
With the WhatsApp. Oh, God. And folding pizza boxes as a family. Terrifying.
Folding pizza boxes.
And doing it wrong.
So, like, yeah, and then doing it wrong.
I think they did a good job in showing, like, it wasn't even a circumstance thing. They were all just a bunch of bums, too. Honestly. Like, they were all, when are you going to go back to college? I don't know. Like, they were all bumming and slumming their way through, too.
And now, for the second half of the episode, I am joined by friend of the podcast, Daniel Romero.
What's up?
And we're going to talk about Terminator Dark Fate. This movie opened up this past weekend. It is kind of a reboot slash sequel. I don't know how to phrase these anymore. There's too many of these like weird amalgamations.
It's all of it. It's none of it. It's a movie.
It's a movie starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, Linda Hamilton. She's back as Sarah Connor. We got a new entry in Mackenzie Davis, Natalia Reyes, and Gabriel Luna. So, you know, a mix of the old and the new. This was directed by Tim Miller, who also directed Deadpool. It was a bomb, unfortunately. $29 million opening weekend, which is not good for a franchise that spent a lot of money on this movie.
Ouch.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a better way of saying that. Now, critics weren't too harsh on it. I mean, the score, it was a 69. You know, whatever you could do with that, do with that. Audiences seemed to like it at 84%. So, Danny, let's go ahead and get your score out of a, you know, 1 to 5. What did you give Terminator Dark Fate?
I gave it, like, it's a 3. Like, I'm not mad at it. Like, I go into movies like this, I always compare them to Kong Skull Island. Like, it's a fun movie to just sit there and watch for 2 hours, but the substance isn't really there. I'm not that engaged with the characters, which, you know, sucks. Like, I wish we had Jessica on this episode because of how much crap she talks about Terminator 2. I would love to hear her opinion on this movie. But so, Terminator 2 is fantastic, and this just doesn't live up to it.
Yeah, I want to go ahead and address that really fast. For those who have been listening to us and have not heard this terrible take that Jessica has, and I'm going to use this opportunity that she's not on here to not defend herself. It's not that she believes that Terminator 1 is better than Terminator 2. If you have that opinion, I'm not going to say you're wrong or not. What her opinion is, that Terminator 2 is a bad movie, and I am sorry, but that is wrong.
Definitely wrong.
Yes. I think you and I share that Terminator 2 is one of the greatest action movies of all time.
For sure.
Easily. I think it has an amazing villain. I think the concept of turning the villain into a semi-hero is really cool. And I don't get why she says it's a bad movie, other than the fact that she hates sequels.
Yeah, no, she really does hate sequels, and it's one of those where, I mean, I'd argue that it's better than the original Terminator, but they're also two different movies. Like, the Terminator is a great horror movie,
yes,
and T2 is a great action movie.
Yeah. And he, what's it called? James Cameron did the same thing with Alien and Aliens. Like, Alien is a fantastic horror movie in space, trapped, claustrophobic, and then Part 2 kind of shifts into more of an action style of movie. And I think they're both great, and I think Terminator 2 is amazing. And yeah, Jessica's wrong. So
yeah, for sure.
Back to Terminator Dark Fate. So you gave it a 3. I gave it a 3 as well. I think mixing in the old, so bringing in Sarah Connor, aka Linda Hamilton, back into the fold, also introducing new characters, which, how they're introduced and how they convey these characters, I did not realize we would be spending so much time dealing with characters who did not speak English, or, you know, where...
Yeah, there was a lot of this movie in subtitles, which, I mean, was not a huge chunk of it in reality. It was maybe, like, what, like 5-10 minutes, but more than you'd think in a big franchise blockbuster, yeah.
Right, and the movie kind of centers around a Hispanic female character, and also the villain is a Hispanic male. So
yep.
I was, at least from the advertising, it kind of seemed that way. But I didn't think it would be so heavy into this is a Hispanic character and we're going to really center around them.
Yeah. The marketing of the movie, you just mentioned the advertising. That was one thing that I will give this movie. They did a really, really good job of. This movie, like, everything that was shown in the trailers was, what, in the first 15, 20 minutes of the movie?
That first trailer, for sure. There was a second trailer that showed just a little bit more, but it didn't show the end, which was surprising. Like, what's it called? I believe it was basically, like, the final sequence that takes place I don't want to spoil it, but there's a final sequence that takes place inside of a factory looking place that was definitely not in the trailers, either one of them.
Yeah,
but you are right. The marketing didn't really spoil anything major or specific, which is good on them, because most times blockbusters like these, they just ruin it by, hey, it's in the trailer, and now who cares?
Yep, exactly.
So now, before we get into spoilers, did you have any general thoughts on, let's say, bringing back someone like Linda Hamilton for this?
Yes. You think
it was a good idea, right?
I think so. I've read a few things, heard a few different, opinions in the movies. When it comes, so this is the fourth sequel that there's been since T2, and even though we're giving it a 3, like, it's definitely the best of those four that have come out. And I think what the franchise has been missing is not Arnold Schwarzenegger coming back. It was like a big deal when they did Terminator Salvation and he wasn't in that movie. It's not him. He's not the center of this franchise. It's Sarah Connor. So bringing her back was a good move. I remember when they first announced it, we were actually on a tram. I don't know if you were with us. We were on a tram to Disney Hollywood Studios. And I read that and I was like, great. Linda Hamilton coming back, James Cameron coming back. We're just going to have to wait for 47 Avatar movies to finish before we get a good Terminator movie. and surprisingly, we got this first and we got an okay Terminator movie. So having her back was great. Having, James Cameron back as the director. I'm not a huge James Cameron fan, but I do think the Terminator stuff is some of his better work. So it was cool to have him back. But I think it wasn't as good as I think it could have been. Another thought I have about it, and we've, said the same thing in the Zombieland Double Tap episode. Had this been the sequel to come right after Terminator Judgment Day, might be taken a little bit better. Because you're also expecting fans who have watched these terrible sequels for the last, 15 years to now forget that those exist, period. Like, they never happened. So I think it's asking a lot of casual fans to understand. So even though she's back, it helps. It makes the movie better and brings that nostalgia factor. But it's not enough to make it like a great film.
No, and I think you're right about that, because this movie, if, like you said, if it would have been the very next movie in this franchise, I don't think there would be the fatigue that there is now with the franchise. I think when people hear the word Terminator, they're like, oh, another one? In a very sarcastic tone.
Yeah.
And it shows in the box office when it made only $29 million. Pretty weak opening.
Yeah. And it's because, like, it's not only that they've made more sequels, they've tried to reboot it so many times. Oh. Terminator, I've actually never seen Terminator 3. That's a continuation of, like, Judgment Day, right?
Yes, and it is not good.
Yeah, I've heard that's not good. Salvation, basically a reboot, ties nothing to the main one. Genesis, whatever the hell that garbage was trying to be a reboot. This is the one that gets closest to being a successful reboot of the franchise, and we'll go into like more of why when we get into spoilers. But I just don't care.
That's a fair point right there. That is very fair. I think we can jump into spoilers, but before we do, there is one thing that I was also surprised with. This movie, Arnold is back, but he is not the star, just like you were saying. It's surrounded by three women. You have Linda Hamilton as Sarah Connor, who comes back. You have Mackenzie Davis, who comes from the future to protect the person that they're protecting, which happens to be played by Natalia Reyes. And so seeing three different women being the lead, I think that was great way of, inserting new blood into the movie instead of we need to do John Connor again, because it didn't work in Salvation. And I think they tried to do it again in Genesis, where instead of it being... How was it again in Genesis?
I don't know. I just remember Genesis, the big twist was that John Connor was actually the villain in that movie, which was shown in a trailer. Had that not been revealed in a trailer, that might have been a much better movie. That's the movie that made me absolutely despise Emilia Clarke. Because it is so bad, and she does not help at all. Solo redeemed her a little bit for me, but God, she is just awful in that, as is everybody and everything.
Yeah. We'll see how she does in Last Christmas coming out in like this week. So let's go ahead and let's jump right into spoilers.
The greatest trick.
Houston, we have a problem.
I am your father.
I see dead people.
The devil ever pulled.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Was convincing the world.
You can't handle the truth.
He didn't exist.
Oh, what's in the box?
Okay, so what's the first thing you want to talk about? Because there's a couple of different directions I think we could go with this.
Let's start with John Connor.
Yeah, okay. So I think that opening the movie with just a slightly older John Connor and Sarah Connor from the T2 version, I thought was pretty cool. I think the CGI is really good in that moment as well.
The CGI is great. Like
the de-aging is crazy.
They de-aged her, and it was what? Kind of like what they did with Princess Leia in Rogue One for John, yeah, right?
Exactly. That's exactly what they did. And then they even de-age Arnold as well.
Yeah.
For that moment. And even I took my mom to see this movie because she was interested. And she was like, how did they do that? Like, she was like so surprised that they were able to get young Linda Hamilton.
Yeah.
And so for a moment I thought it was, is this a scene maybe that they never
didn't
used before?
Use? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, no, it was crazy.
It was really good, I think. So overall, I think the CGI in the movie is solid. You could tell there's certain moments and certain action scenes where you could tell it's just they're against the green screen and,
yeah, you know,
it's a little weak. But speaking of CGI, what did you think about the villain? How they, the new monster or the new, you know, robot that he
is? Yeah, the Rev 9. He was fine. The actor Gabriel Luna, I think he did a good job. I don't know what else he's done besides he was Ghost Rider on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on TV, which I don't know anybody that watches, but
no,
he's there. I watched it. It was fine. But he was fine as far as what he is, this Rev 9, this new like generation of Terminator and this new future they've created. Was he not just a T-1000? Like,
He pretty much is the same thing, just that in this version, not only could he do the liquid, you know, to change himself, but he also could kind of disconnect himself and become second robot.
Yeah. Like, so, his, like, exo whatever could separate from the Terminator itself. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, so that was kind of cool.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's an interesting. Now that we're speaking about new robots, what about the introduction of Mackenzie Davis's character and the fact that she is actually human, I found a little bit surprising.
I did too, and I really, really liked her character. I liked how they handled it. I liked her role in the overall story, which is why I'm really bummed if this continues being a franchise that was the end of her story. I feel like she was one of the better parts of the movie.
Oh, she was. So Mackenzie Davis, for those who don't know, she is probably in one of the most popular episodes of Black Mirror, San Junipero. She's going to be in a movie really soon, The Taking, I believe. It's a horror movie. But she is really good because not only does she show that she is a fierce character, but she also is a very sympathetic character because you can really, not only with what she says, but with how she acts and how she shows empathy towards other characters, that she cares. She cares about what she's doing. It's not like a normal machine that just, it's on a mission and that's it. So I thought that was a nice one. And also the fact that she's enhanced. She's a human, but she's enhanced.
Yeah. So I thought that was really, really cool. Like the backstory they gave her was awesome, where she's from the future, just like, you know, the Rev 9, the other Terminators. Mm. But she's growing up in this world where Skynet basically won. So still, Sarah Connor and John Connor stopped Judgment Day, but, you know, what's meant to be will be. And there's still this, you know, Terminator uprising,
right, called Legion this time around.
Yeah, so not Skynet, but still Skynet, basically. And, you know, she's there fighting for food and she gets, you know, caught up with this, you know, gang of people who are trying to, you know, just take whatever she's collected for herself so that she can survive. She lost her family. And then you find out, you know, some other people come into play. I guess we'll talk about that in a little bit. That kind of tie her back to the main story. I thought they did a really, really good job of not just shoving in a new character because they needed a new character. She fit well with the overall narrative.
Yeah, she did. And let's talk about the little change that they made this time around in terms of the lead character. So I'm talking about Natalia Reyes' character. Because in the prior Terminator movies, it's always been someone has been sent back to save John Connor. And they usually send them back to protect the mother. Mm-hmm. So that's where Sarah Connor gets involved in the first Terminator. And so in this movie...
Yeah, and this was one twist that, I mean, it was really predictable. I saw coming super early on. As when they're having that conversation on the train, because they, you know, obviously, you know, the, since it's based around this family in Mexico City, they have to get to Texas. So they have to cross the border. Definitely no, you know, subtext there at all.
No, not at all.
But so they have to, you know, just hop a ride in this train and they're having this conversation, Sarah Connor and the other two, where they're explaining to Daniela, Natalia Reyes' character, why she's the one that needs to be protected. And I feel like Mackenzie Davis is about to tell her, but Linda Hamilton's just like, no, it's what's, you're not the important one. It's what you're going to carry. It's your son. And then I don't know why Grace Mackenzie Davis just keeps her mouth shut at that point and makes it like this big thing later on. Like, they're not protecting her son. She was going to be the one to lead the uprising. Like, as soon as that like conversation happened, I was like, that's it. Like, that's the big twist in this movie, which is whatever.
Yeah. But I mean, I did like the fact that it's not that she's going to carry the savior. She is the savior of the future, which I found to be pretty interesting because most of the time it's always like the guy savior, number one. So changing it to a female, different, and also making it a minority as well.
Yeah,
that was cool. Uprising was pretty interesting as well. So overall points for them on that. Yes, you are right, though. This movie telegraphs this twist, and I'm putting that in quotes, because you have that moment, and the moment that I realized is when we see the flashback to Grace's character. She is in the future. She is carrying the body of her commander, and very, you know, conveniently never show the face of this commander.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm just like, I wonder who this commander could be. And so in my head, I'm thinking, I wonder if it's the girl. So, and then I added your analysis when they were on the train. So I put the two together. I was like, oh, she's got to be the commander then. So it wasn't a huge reveal, at least for us, you know, picking up on the little clues that the movie gives. But overall, still, I think it's a nice little twist on the story.
Yep.
Now, is there any... Let's talk about Arnold.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's the other twist.
That is the other twist. So we see, in this movie at least, we see Arnold at the very beginning of the movie. He kills John Connor.
John Connor.
Yeah. Kills him in a different alternate reality, pretty much, or in an alternate
timeline. No. That's not the alternate timeline. It said that was 6 months after when Judgment Day was supposed to be or something like that.
You're right.
Yeah, so what was your thoughts on that? Because for me, like, it's not like it retconned. It didn't undo the plot of T2.
No, it didn't.
But I feel like it cheapened it so much.
Because
Judgment Day was prevented, but he still died.
He still died. That's crazy to me because everything about part one and part two is about we need to save John Connor. He is the future salvation of human race. And this movie in the first 5 minutes was like, well, he's done. He's dead. So, and then on top of that, we still get a future of robots taking over. So,
like, was it in vain, all of it?
Right. Like, is it in vain? Is it something that's supposed to happen? And
there's a throwaway line where Sarah Connor just says, "Oh, they never learn." And that's why they explain that there's a new robot uprising.
It's not.
And that's it. Like, I felt, so this movie to me, like, When I saw that happen, like, just that there was just this new future where the same thing that was meant to happen was going to happen, it reminded me of a lot of, like, the people who complained about The Force Awakens, how it's kind of just like a, you know, rehash of A New Hope.
Yeah.
I mean, in this case, I like The Force Awakens, so I mean, sure, I'm okay with it there. But that's what this movie feels like. It hits the same points as Terminator and T2. Like,
yeah. They're just making slight adjustments where now the central figure is female. So, you know, that's where you can view the similarities with, like, The Force Awakens. Yeah. And I don't mean that, like, in a bad way. I'm just saying, like, those are the things that this movie did that also Force Awakens did as well. But having Arnold back wasn't bad.
No.
Because that machine that kills John Connor at the beginning of the movie, we see him later on. He's grown old. He has a white beard. I guess they're
actually... His name is Carl.
His name is Carl, and he does drapes. he has an entire cover. He has a family. So apparently he grew a conscience, and by that it's like the equivalent of what a human conscience would be.
Yeah,
he's adapting as a robot. How did you feel about that in terms of the story?
At first, I was like, "That's some bullcrap. He's a robot. How is he gonna? How is he gonna develop a family? And how is he gonna, you know, love in a sense?" And then I thought about it, and I was like, "Well, I guess back in T2, like the whole like hasta la vista, baby. That was the Terminator, like." Learning to adapt to humanity, to, you know, protecting John. So it's not, I guess it's not impossible. It was fine. I guess it was an interesting way to kind of bring him into the fold rather than, yep, in the future, there's just a lot of Terminators that look like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. And this movie does a thing where it doesn't really explain it, or it doesn't explain it well. But for some reason, Linda Hamilton's character of Sarah Connor goes around killing Terminators. And she knows that these Terminators are coming because she receives a text every mm-hmm. time that a new one is coming. So she shows up to destroy it. And I don't think we got a really good answer as to how it was done. It was like supposedly the future sends shockwaves or something like that. And so
yeah, like when... When the Terminators come in and they're like everything like freezes and there's like the electricity spikes or whatever, I guess that's how it is. And then Arnold, without Sarah Connor knowing, would be sending her the coordinates with the text messages saying for John, because because of the family that he developed, he grew guilty that he took that away from her.
Right, exactly. And so, yeah, he grows guilt as a robot. He grows a conscience as a robot. The family that he adopts, because he basically adopts a family, he has a woman and an adopted son. It's not physical, because they said that in the movie.
They made an effort for that.
Yeah, they're like, she doesn't know, so how are you? And he quickly is like, our relationship is not physical. So that's how they explain away the fact that she doesn't know, except for the fact that he is like probably 400 pounds.
Yeah.
So... I think overall there's a couple some of the story beats just either don't fit in well, or they just feel just a little cheap, only because we've seen it before. Like, for example, we have the Rev 9. We've seen this machine before. All they did was enhance it just a little bit, just to give us a slight difference. I think that having a robot grow a conscience is kind of strange. Although, you know, with your explanation of Terminator 2, it makes a little more sense, but still just the way they just offhandedly throw, well, you grew a conscience? Impossible.
Yeah.
And that is like an equivalent to one. And it's like, yeah, okay, that doesn't really solve anything. And then the final thing that I think that I want to talk about is the final act of the movie.
Yeah.
This movie turns into, as most action movies nowadays do, turns into like this just like CGI porn, pretty much, where it's just too much CGI crap that's on screen. So it's hard to really like dive into like, oh, I'm really rooting for something good to happen to the good characters. And then a lot of the stuff is like crazy, like a plane is falling, right? And they're kind of like just like floating around in the airplane, almost like if it was zero gravity.
Yep.
I didn't get that.
Yeah, I didn't either. But that it really started, it, like most of these movies, it really kind of falls apart towards the end there. Right. That was unbelievable. And they get in the Humvee and they're just falling. And like when they cut back to the shots of, I think it's Mackenzie Davis and Natalia Reyes, in like they're fine. Like they're not panicking or anything.
No. And then a plane crashes into another plane. That plane that's crashing crashes into the Hoover Dam.
Gosh.
And then like the Humvee is on the edge of the dam, then it slides all the way down, and of course it doesn't, you know, crush beneath anything, and everybody inside the Humvee is fine.
Fine. Yep.
Totally fine. No, not a scratch. It doesn't make sense. So yeah, that's why I think a lot of these action movies struggle with their third acts, because they rely so much on it needs to be big.
Yeah.
That it's just like, well, what can we throw at it? So that's why, like, for example, I think that I like the scene in the middle, action scene wise. I like this in the detention center.
Yeah.
The detention center is really good. We see the Rev 9 with some of his new powers. And, you know, the way he's hunting these characters down, I think that's good. How'd you feel about the opening chase, like the main chase at the beginning that was in the trailers?
I thought that was really cool.
I thought it was cool, too.
And the one thing I had with it was like, all right, how does Sarah Connor know to show up right here, right now, in this moment? They kind of explained it later, so it's fine. Yeah. But yeah, no, I thought that chase was awesome.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. So a lot of action movies nowadays, it's they do a really good job about the earlier sequences, and then the final sequence always has to be too big. And so they never know how to rein it in. And so that's my biggest problem with the third act.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Yeah. No, another issue I kind of had with it was they kind of threw in this subplot. I guess it's one of those points that just didn't make sense, was that Mackenzie Davis, she could fight for a little bit and then she basically shuts down.
Yeah.
Like you see it in the beginning, that kind of ends up being what brings Sarah Connor closer into the fold. And then it doesn't happen the entire movie until that fight at the end when they need it not to. Like, it was just, it's a crutch because they needed a crutch.
They needed a crutch. They needed a way to weaken our hero so that way she could overcome the odds.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was such a weird thing. It was like, oh, she needs to be
ejected. It felt really random.
Yeah, it really did, because she was asking for all these like ingredients at a pharmacy early on in the movie, like sodium, whatever, and you know, she needs to be shot with it, almost like a diabetic, pretty much. That she's a machine that's a diabetic. That's pretty much what this movie has our hero
basically.
So I think those little things is what brings our scores down, I believe.
Yeah.
Now here is a question that we have from Colby at Colby Told Me. He is a friend of the show. He asks, in regards to Terminator, have we matured as an audience past these types of stories? This was a cool premise in the 80s, but it feels like the stuff we grew out of and nostalgia is not working. Oof. That, I mean, I think it's more about the fact that we got so much bad after part two.
Yeah, like, it. I don't think the premise is bad. I mean, using Star Wars as an example, they remade A New Hope, but they remade it good. Like, they could have hit the same beats as Terminator and kind of gotten rid of a lot of the fluff of this movie, and it would have been a lot better. Like, I found myself towards the end of this movie, you know, looking at my watch like, crap, when's this thing going to be over? Like, they could have cut, you know, 20-30 minutes out of this movie and it would have been a lot better. As far as the story and, you know, the whole time travel thing and sending someone back from the future to save the past, like, I think if it's done well, it's fine.
Yeah. If it's done well, it's fine, because we've seen it twice already in this franchise. Well, more than twice.
Yeah. But
successfully in good movies, we've seen it twice already. So I don't think we've matured out of it. I think it's a good premise to have. It's just that we had so much crap in between that it just kind of tainted the way we viewed it.
Yep.
So now, before we get out of here, do you have any major sticking points that you wanted to talk about on the movie at all?
No, I mean, the movie leaves us kind of with this lead into what could possibly be a future franchise or continuation of the franchise. Mackenzie Davis' character, or at the end, you know, sacrifices herself so that they can take out the Rev 9 and save Daniela. So you see her, you know, future self, she's out of the picture. But then the very last scene in the movie shows Sarah Connor and Daniela, now, you know, watching some little girl playing at a playground that you find out is this little girl going to grow up to be Grace, which is cool. And then, you know, so she's just, or Daniela's just looking kind of through a fence watching this girl play. And then you hear some honks like Sarah Connor saying, get with it, let's go. And they get into this like Jeep and they drive away, kind of, you know, hinting at the fact that Sarah Connor is going to train her into being this like leader of the uprising.
Pretty much.
Which is cool.
Yeah.
But again, do we care anymore? Like,
I just think that the name Terminator is just too, it's been dragged through.
It's been tainted.
It's been tainted. And at the end of the day, if you give us another Terminator movie, audiences will be like, again? Not necessarily because they hate the story. It's just that we were served with some bad stuff and audiences are not ready to trust again.
Yeah.
So, it sounds like you would be interested in seeing a sequel, I guess, depending on what they did with it, right?
In the world of AMC A-list, yes, I'd be interested in seeing a sequel. Do I want to pay for it? No, but if it's out there, I'll go see it. That's how I felt about this one.
Yeah, that you are right about that. God bless AMC A-list. Oh, man. I think there's nothing from this movie that'll be mentioned at the end of the year, like, best of this. No, right?
No, yeah. I don't think so.
Yeah, and this movie was nowhere near my top 10 for the year.
Nope.
But it's, like, right in the middle. It's a 3. It's like, yeah, it's good, but it's also bad. You know?
I've seen worse this year, but I've also seen way, way better.
Exactly. And we're really starting to ramp up here in this final couple of months where it's just going to be a lot of movies and it's just going to be like,
yep.
I'm not going to have time to watch them all. So it's going to be interesting.
Yep.
Final thoughts.
Sarah Connor's cool. This movie's lame. Just, that's it. There's nothing else to it. Could have been better. It's not the worst.
That's the tagline they should use. Terminator Dark Fate. Sarah Connor's cool. This movie's lame.
Yep.
All right. With that, Danny, I want to thank you for coming on for this episode.
Yeah, for sure.
And for those who are listening for the first time, go ahead and hit the subscribe button. We would greatly appreciate if you listen to future episodes or go back and listen to our old episodes. If you are on social media, go ahead and check us out at Always Critic Pod. We are on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. So tune in next week for a brand new episode of the Always the Critic podcast. We will catch you then.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.